Thanks, Lou. So do keep the passage open. As I was preparing for this morning, I was struck by the fact that what we do here on a Sunday, praying together, looking at the Bible, singing songs to worship God, it's not what most people are doing today. We're definitely in the minority. If we think about what other people are doing here in Southampton or in the rest of the country, and we could ask ourselves, why do we do this? Is it a good use of our time coming here on a Sunday? Does it make any difference? And hopefully the answer to that is yes. It is worth meeting together. It is helpful to sing and to pray and to listen to God's word together. And there's a lot in this passage that we're looking at this morning, the one that Kevin just read to us. And if we ask the question, what is this all about? Having read it, we might say, it's about faith. It's about the importance of faith or the effect that faith can have. And it's also about paying taxes, something that all of us do, probably more often than we realize. And if we ask the question, what happens in this passage, then the answer is slightly different. There are miracles here, and there's movement, and there's questions from different people. And words that Jesus spoke, which seem to express his frustration, but which also contain hope and a clear reminder of what Jesus was about to face. But before we get into the detail of all that, let's just pause. Let's think about the context of this passage and what's already happened. We're working our way through Matthew's gospel. As Lou said, it's Matthew's account of Jesus' life. We're up to chapter 17 now, which is just a bit over halfway through the book. But in terms of what's happening, we're getting close to the end of Jesus' life. He's been doing miracles. He's been teaching his disciples. Opposition has been growing from the religious leaders. And now, after a few years of all that, Jesus begins to speak clearly to his disciples about what's going to happen to him next. And Peter, in the previous chapters, just answered the question, who do you say I am? And he correctly identifies Jesus as the Messiah, the Son of the living God. But then when Jesus said that he's going to Jerusalem to be handed over to the authorities and killed, Peter doesn't like that. His reaction is to take Jesus aside, and he says to Jesus, this will never happen, never. And we can understand why Peter would say such a thing. He cares deeply about Jesus, but he's clearly got it wrong. And so Jesus tells him that he's a stumbling block. He's an obstacle. Peter doesn't understand what God is doing. He's only concerned about human things. That's what Jesus says. If you think about it, that must have been a shock to Peter. Hard for him to hear, but something for us to think about too. What are we most concerned about this morning? Here we are. What's on our minds? What's in our hearts? Do we have in mind God's concerns? Do we have in mind human concerns? If we're honest, that's quite a challenge, isn't it? And what would we say about Jesus? If someone asked us, who would we say Jesus is? Is he the Lord of our lives? Is he the one who has control over the things that we do, the things that we say? Is he the one that we trust to save us, to help us, to guide us? Let's be clear, it's obviously not wrong to have human concerns, all of us do, but it's a big mistake to react like Peter does and to think that we are the ones who know what should happen, what shouldn't happen, or if we try to restrict or limit Jesus in terms of what he can or should do. Last week we looked at chapter 17, the beginning of chapter 17, where Peter, James, and John are taken by Jesus up a mountain. And we know what happens there. Something extraordinary happens there. Something unexpected happens. And they witness Jesus' transformation. And part of Jesus' true nature is revealed to them, his true identity. And there's Moses and Elijah who appear. They speak with Jesus. We're not told what they say or what they talk about, but Peter starts to make some suggestions, and then they're all covered by this cloud, and they hear the voice of God saying about Jesus, "This is my son. Listen to him." Hard to imagine, but this experience, we're told, is terrifying for the three disciples. They are overwhelmed. They fall to the ground. But Jesus says, "Don't be afraid." And then he says, "Don't tell anyone about this until I've been raised from the dead." And it's always good to think about the things that Jesus says and what he does, and to keep reading about these things, because, to be honest, it happened a very long time ago. Jesus lived, he died, he rose again. That's what we believe. But it can all seem quite distant and unreal in everyday life. And I think we need to keep being reminded of these things in order to enter into the reality of who Jesus is, the reality of his existence, the power of his teaching. We need to feel the impact of his words and the emotion of being caught up with his life. Because following Jesus isn't something we do in theory. It's not something that we just talk about from time to time. It has to be practical. It has to be real. We have to live it out. And on their way down from the mountain, the disciples are asking Jesus questions. And I'm sure we would have been asking questions too. They have questions about Elijah, about the things that they've heard taught about Elijah. And Jesus helps them to understand a bit more about what's going on. They make the connection between what happened to John the Baptist. And Jesus uses that to speak to them about the suffering that's ahead of him, preparing them. So Jesus is preparing them as he faces his future. He's preparing them for what's going to happen, even though there's so much that they don't understand. Now, this emphasis on suffering and on what's about to happen to Jesus, we need to take on board as well, I think. Jesus was really focused on completing everything that his Father had called him to do. He knew what was ahead, and he wasn't afraid. When they descended from the mountain, there was a crowd waiting for them. Things had been happening while they'd been gone, and now there's another situation for Jesus to deal with. Remember, on the mountain, God had spoken. He'd spoken the same words that he'd said at Jesus' baptism. "This is my son, whom I love." A son who we've been told is soon going to suffer at the hands of men. And now a man approaches Jesus and kneels before him and says, "Lord, have mercy on my son." This is a man who clearly loves his son too. And he must have been very distressed by what was happening to him. He tells Jesus that his son has seizures and is suffering greatly, and that he often falls into the fire or into the water. And we can only imagine how helpless that man felt, that father. Perhaps we've heard of similar circumstances, similar situations, or maybe there are people that we know personally, families and children, who are also suffering a lot at the moment. Or we can think about what's happening in many parts of the world where there are all kinds of distress because of war, famine, people who've lost their homes, lost their families. And we can often feel helpless when we're faced with specific problems, difficult situations, or we can be overwhelmed because of the scale of suffering caused by war. And I'm sure that the father here would have tried to find help. He would have wanted help for his son. He would have gone to doctors or other people. He says that he brought his son to the disciples, but they couldn't heal him. And that prompts Jesus to say something which is quite harsh and severe. "You unbelieving and perverse generation, how long shall I put up with you? How long shall I stay with you?" And these are words that grab our attention because they're not what we would expect Jesus to say. But nonetheless, they're revealing, aren't they? They show us what Jesus was thinking, what he was feeling, what he was facing, what he was up against. And perhaps this makes us wonder what Jesus would say to us today. What would he say about us? Are we part of an unbelieving and perverse generation too? I think undoubtedly we are. We look around us and it's not the way it should be. And that should prompt us to pay attention to what Jesus goes on to say next. Jesus, as we've read, tells the Father to bring the boy to him. Jesus then simply rebukes the demon. It comes out of the boy and he's healed. Jesus does what his disciples couldn't do. He does what no one else has been able to do. He heals the boy right there and then. And it's not the first time that his disciples have witnessed this kind of miracle. Bang, it's done. And I'm sure the Father would have felt such relief, would have felt such gratitude towards Jesus. His son's life has been saved, transformed. And Jesus has shown mercy, just as the man had asked him to do. And Matthew doesn't tell us now how the crowd who were there reacts, but instead, he mentions that the disciples come to Jesus in private, and they ask him why they couldn't drive out the demon. And it's a good question to ask. It's good that they ask this question, because we've probably been all in that situation ourselves where we've tried to do something or we've prayed for someone and it hasn't worked. Nothing has happened. So what's Jesus' answer to their question? Why weren't they able to do it? It's pretty straightforward, isn't it? He says it's because you have too little faith. Not enough faith to drive out this demon. And what do we make of that? What do we make of that response from Jesus? What do you understand from this statement? You have too little faith. It's actually something that Jesus has said to them before. In fact, this is the fifth time Jesus has said the exact same thing to them. And five times Matthew quotes Jesus using this word that means little faith. Five times. The first time was when Jesus was preaching the Sermon on the Mount, when Jesus was telling them not to worry about what they will eat or drink or what they will wear. The next time is when the disciples are in a boat on the lake. There's a huge storm. Jesus is asleep. They wake him up saying that they're going to drown. After that, it's the time when Peter sees Jesus walking on the water and tries to do the same, but then starts to sink when he takes his eyes off Jesus. And then in chapter 16, so just the previous chapter, the disciples, again, are crossing the lake and they've forgotten to bring bread with them. But they've also forgotten about how Jesus fed the 5,000 and the 4,000 with just a few loaves of bread and fish. And in each of these situations, Jesus highlights the littleness of their faith. And in answer to their question, why couldn't we drive out the demon? Jesus is very honest. And he gives them a straight answer. Too little faith. But then he goes on to encourage them, I think. He says, truly I tell you, if you have faith as small as a mustard seed, you can say to this mountain, move from here to there, and it will move. Nothing will be impossible for you. It's encouraging, isn't it? It seems that only having a little faith, a tiny little amount of faith, is not a problem. Having no faith at all, being part of an unbelieving generation, is a different matter. But having a little faith, with a little faith, we can move mountains. And we can easily find ourselves in the same situation as the disciples here. or feeling the same thing, a sense of disappointment or frustration or confusion because we don't see answers to our prayers, or that things that we try to do fail. But perhaps Jesus wants to draw our attention not to how much faith we have, but who our faith is in. There's a suggestion here that the disciples may have been focusing too much on their own abilities when they were trying to help the man's son, because the question they asked Jesus was, why couldn't they drive out the demon? Earlier on, Matthew tells us that Jesus had given them authority to drive out impure spirits and to heal every disease and illness, but it wasn't their power or authority that produced the miracles or brought about healing. It was always, always God's power, God's doing. And even with Jesus, this was true. He said quite clearly that he only did what he saw his father doing. And on the day of Pentecost, Peter, the same Peter, spoke about Jesus and said these words: Jesus was a man accredited by God to you by miracles, wonders, and signs which God did among you through him. So when Jesus performed miracles, it was God working through him. And then Peter and John, they helped a man who had been lame since birth and was begging at the temple courts. And afterwards, when people saw what had happened, Peter asked them, "Why do you stare at us as if by our own power or godliness we had made this man walk?" So the implication is clear. The miracles don't happen because of any power or goodness or godliness that we possess in ourselves. Faith that can move mountains is faith in the God who made the universe. It's believing in him that makes all the difference. In one sense, I think we would all love to be able to heal people, to perform miracles. But it's something that only God can do. If we want to see miracles, if we want to see people healed, then what we need to do is to put all our trust, all our confidence in God. And in faith, ask him to do the things that are beyond us, beyond our power, beyond our ability. And that's what we're encouraged to do when we read Matthew's gospel or any of the three gospels. Faith, or four gospels, the other three gospels, faith is only mentioned a few times, a handful of times. But when it is, it's almost always people coming to Jesus for healing, asking Jesus to heal them. And often they're commended for their great faith, or they're told that their faith has healed them. If we focus on doing the things that we're told to do, then I believe we will see miracles. We'll see signs and wonders and miracles if we do what God tells us to do. And when the Father spoke from the cloud on the mountain, he said, "This is my son. Listen to him." So we should listen to him. And if we make listening to Jesus our priority, if we make listening to Jesus and doing what Jesus says our priority, then I'm sure we will see him do more and more and more. And our little faith, our tiny faith, will grow and grow. So that's really what I wanted to say this morning. Let's keep listening to Jesus. Let's listen to these important words. Listen to all the things that he says. Take them to heart. Because Jesus says, "Truly I tell you, if you have faith as small as a mustard seed, you can say to this mountain, 'Move,' and it'll move." Nothing. Nothing, Jesus says, will be impossible for you. So we need to hear these words. They are words of promise. And we need to put our trust in the one who makes the promise. That's what faith is. And faith really is the key to everything. Nothing will be impossible for you. That's what Jesus says here. Nothing will be impossible for you. Not because of any power or godliness that we possess, but because of the faithfulness of the one who speaks the promise. And that's why we should listen. That's why we should believe in him. And that's why we should trust him wholeheartedly. And we know that we can trust him. We know that we can trust him because of what Matthew goes on to say next. When they came together in Galilee, Jesus said to them, "The Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men. They will kill him, and on the third day he will be raised to life." When we read this verse, we don't react in the same way as the disciples did when they heard Jesus say these things. Matthew tells us that they were filled with grief, and we can understand why. But for us, when we listen to what Jesus is saying, when we hear these words, what we hear is a statement of faith from Jesus. This is Jesus expressing his trust and his faith in what God has said. Jesus knows what's going to happen. He makes it very clear. He trusts his Father 100%. He has total confidence in his Father's love for him and in the promise of resurrection life. And we can read in other places. In Hebrews chapter 12, it talks about Jesus being the author and perfecter of faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorning its shame. Jesus went to the cross full of faith. Jesus had unswerving, unshakable faith, complete trust, total conviction. And because of that, we can have hope. Jesus is the pioneer, the one who goes first, the perfecter of faith. He is our inspiration. He is the foundation of our trust in God. Our hope is built on nothing less than Jesus' blood and righteousness. We sing that, don't we? And then Matthew tells us that Jesus and his disciples journey a bit further. This time it's just a short distance to Capernaum, where the collectors of the temple tax come to Peter with a question. And this is the question: doesn't your teacher pay the temple tax? And think about it. Peter's been through some real roller coaster moments, and here's another one. He tells them, yes, Jesus does pay the tax, but we don't know how Peter feels about this question, or if he's even sure of his answer. Does Jesus pay taxes or not? Was this some kind of trap to catch Peter out or to get Jesus into trouble? We just don't know. But we know that when he enters the house, it's Jesus who speaks first, and he asks Peter another question about taxes. From whom do the kings of the earth collect duties and taxes? From their own children or from others? And perhaps this is an easier question for Peter to answer. From others, he says. Then the children are exempt, Jesus says. No need for the children to pay any taxes. That's how it works. And it seems like Jesus is telling Peter that there's no need to worry. No need to worry about trying to find money to pay the temple tax or perhaps any of the taxes, because they are children of God's kingdom. And in Capernaum, Peter is back on home territory. It's his hometown. It's possible that being there reminds him of what he's left behind to follow Jesus. He's left behind his job, his security. He was a fisherman. He had a regular source of income. And perhaps like us, money is something that Peter worries about. And paying taxes is part of life, and not much of a problem if you have a decent wage. But Peter has given up all of that to follow Jesus full time. He's given up fishing in order to become a fisher of men. So maybe all of that's going through his mind. But as always, Jesus has everything in hand. Even though he said that they're exempt, Jesus is concerned about not causing offense or causing anyone to stumble over this. So he tells Peter to go fishing, and that the first fish Peter catches will have a coin in its mouth to pay the tax for both of them. That's incredible, isn't it? But what is Jesus doing here? Jesus is giving Peter an opportunity to listen to him and to trust what he says and to do what he says. And this is the way that faith is built up. This is the way that faith is strengthened. If Peter does what Jesus tells him to do and he finds a coin in the mouth of the first fish that he catches, then he will know that he can trust Jesus for other things. He will experience that miracle, because how can Jesus possibly know that the first fish that Peter catches will have a coin in its mouth? It's ridiculous, isn't it? But it's not ridiculous, because Jesus knows everything. And Jesus is revealing, once again, something about himself, something personal to Peter, something that he would remember, something that will rebuild Peter's faith. Because the temple tax probably isn't a lot of money. But Jesus probably doesn't have any money. And he's wanting to demonstrate something to Peter. Remember before, when Jesus said to Peter, "You are an obstacle, you are a stumbling block." Well, he's using the same word here when he talks about not causing offense. It's the same word. And he wants Peter to trust him. He wants Peter to trust him. Jesus wants Peter to trust him when Jesus says, "I have to go to the cross. I have to die." Jesus wants Peter to trust him when he says that on the third day he will be raised to life. For us, we know that this happens. For Peter, he doesn't. And these are hard things for Peter to accept or even to understand. And perhaps they're hard for us too. And we know that there are more challenges ahead for Peter, but Jesus is wanting Peter to have faith in him and to be able to trust what he says. And this situation with the temple tax and the fish is just a small but important step. And that's where the chapter ends. And as I said at the beginning, if we ask the question, what is today's passage all about? We'd probably say it's about building faith and paying taxes. And as it turns out, in this chapter, paying taxes is an opportunity for Peter to rebuild his faith and to restore his confidence, which is also why Jesus took him up on the mountain, I think. And the message for us is to listen to Jesus. Listen to Jesus and live out our faith. But we need to work out what that means in practice, what that could look like this week. Nothing will be impossible for you. That's what Jesus said. But do we believe it? Do we believe what Jesus says? Do we trust what he says? Nothing will be impossible. And there are things that look impossible for us, things that we're praying for or hoping for, things that are beyond us. Things that are beyond our abilities, things that would be impossible for us to do or to achieve or to make happen. So where does God want us to exercise our faith this week? What does he want us to trust him for? And perhaps we can just take a moment to ask that question. Ask the Lord, what do you want me to trust you for this week? What do you want me to ask you for today as I look ahead to the coming week? So feel free just to close your eyes and pray as we try to listen to what Jesus is saying to us in this moment. And if there is something specific that God is saying to you about faith, about trusting him with the things that are coming this week, then before you leave, it might be good to share that with one other person as an encouragement, as a means of spurring one another on towards love and good deeds.